He's going to speak to us on Shechem, our watershed. We'll turn the podium over to him now.
I'm pleased to bring the love and greetings of your brethren from Jersey City Ecclesia. And as you know, their practice is to do so by means of a scripture. And for this month, they've commissioned me to give you Isaiah 43:2. When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. Isaiah 43:2. I've also been commissioned to convey to you the love and greetings of the English brethren. Last week at this time, we were just beginning a five-day convention at Yeovil. It was a blessed one indeed, and also there followed a couple of days of fellowship with the Aldersbrook Ecclesia in London. And they asked to remember to you, and they gave me Romans 15:13 as their hot wish for you. Now the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that ye may abound in hope through the power of the Holy Spirit. And I will say, dear friends, that your brethren to the east of us in that island of England are rejoicing, and I found them in good spiritual health and found their fellowship a great spiritual stimulation. We thought we might talk a little bit about a city which is located in what is now known as the West Bank area in the province of Samaria, a city which has played an important part in the life of Israel. Also has its companion city, a little town of Bethel. It's interesting to take a historian's point of view and to stand like an objective historian, read the accounts, read what has happened in the various years and decades and centuries of the past, and then to reconstruct from that account lessons that may be applicable to us here. It's like an archaeologist. He does the same thing. He strips off layers of soil, or peels off layers or strata of various accumulation and debris, and is able to put together a documentary of life cycles of peoples, of cities, and of nations. And with the accounts that are given to us in God's Holy Writ, we're able to piece together a very interesting historical perspective of this town of Shechem. And as we study its narrative, it's like we are one of its inhabitants, experiencing the ebb and flow of the destiny of the city, and as it were, we are participating in its fortunes. Shechem is a place of decision where watershed experiences were constantly pouring down. Shechem means shoulder or ridge. Its name derives from its position in the Mount Ephraim range. Now we get that very specifically pinpointed in Joshua 20 and the 7th verse, in 1 Kings 12:25, and in Judges 9:7. These scriptures pinpoint its location, in which Mount Gerizim is on the south, Mount Ebal to the north, the town of Ai is to the east, and Bethel is lying on the west, in a very strategic area, and seems to be one of the central points in which events always seem to be occurring. The name would place Shechem on the shoulder or ridge of the Ephraim range. When we think of a shoulder of a mountain range, the dictionary would define it as such: an area adjacent to or along the edge of a higher, more prominent, or more important part, as 1, the part of a hill or mountain near the top, or 2, a lateral protrusion or extension of a hill or mountain. And therefore, on these rolling hills of the Ephraim range, nestled just within the strategic little basin, was the town of Shechem. And it was very important because it was a watershed. A watershed is apparently an area which divides the manner in which the moisture or precipitation that falls upon it is distributed to the land mass. We have what is known as the Continental Divide. It is along the Rocky Mountains. And wherever water flows or falls on the west side, the Continental Divide will detour and channel all of those waters towards the Pacific Ocean Basin. And on the east side, it will drain into the Mississippi Valley and ultimately into the Gulf of Mexico. When we go along the Ohio Turnpike, we noticed a sign that spoke of the watershed, the Great Lakes, or the Mississippi Basin, which means that all moisture falling on one side of that line would go into the Great Lake area. On the opposite side, it would be to the Mississippi River area as well. And so I thought that was such a beautiful illustration. Shechem was on the ridge and was a watershed, strategically located city. And it would seem to me that all waters that flowed then on the east of Shechem drained into the Mediterranean, all those that flowed into the west of Shechem into the Jordan Valley. And how the moisture falls on Shechem determines where the blessings of God are to be utilized. Whether the blessings would go into the River Jordan and there it would irrigate and make more fertile the deserts about, or into the Mediterranean Ocean there to be lost in the seas and the masses, depended on where and how the water drained and dropped. And so Shechem, as it were, is a place of division, a place of decision, where watershed experiences are pouring down upon us. And we, as we undergo our Shechems, must determine whether those experiences, those blessings, those opportunities are either lost in the Mediterranean Sea or are to be utilized in the Jordan Basin, in the Jordan Valley, there to produce and there to develop and to sustain life and agriculture. And so we thought, dear friends, that a little historical recounting of events transpiring at Shechem, wherein basic, important, critical decisions were made, whereby we see then that it was a watershed area, and determinations were made which were irrevocable. Shechem comes first to our attention early in the scriptural account, as early as the 12th chapter of the book of Genesis, wherein you remember how Abraham was commanded by God to leave Ur of Chaldees. He was to go with his father Terah, and when his father died in Haran, then God informed Abraham that he was now to go into the land that God would show him, that he had covenanted to give unto him, and which in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And in the fourth verse it says, "So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran." And in the sixth verse, "And Abram passed through the land into the place of Shechem," or Shechem, "under the plain of Moreh. And the Canaanite was in the land, and the Lord appeared to Abram and said, Unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west, and Hai on the east. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord." There we find the first introduction of Shechem into the scriptural account. Abram, in following the commandments of his God, settled there, built an altar, and as he then staked out that land, that place, as where God's promises would be accomplished unto him. But Abram moved on. Abram, entrusting his own human thought process, moved on, you know, into that detour into Egypt, where for fear of a famine, he thought his fortunes would be better served by going into the land of Pharaoh. There, you recall, his subterfuge was soon uncovered. He was expelled from Egypt, and he was caused to go back and to retrace his steps back to where he was before he detoured. And in the 13th chapter, in the first verse, and Abram went out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with them, into the south. And then we move on to the third verse. And he went in his journeys from the south, even to Bethel, under the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai, under the place of the altar which he had made there at the first. And there Abram called upon the name of the Lord. See how the Lord, when we do exercise our own wills, when we have our own judgments in matters, do not commit them unto the Lord for his directions and leadership, how the Lord holds us accountable for these detours. And as we do learn the bitter experiences of life, oftentimes receiving some of the chastisements that go with them, he will bring us back to that very position from whence we defected, and we might thereby learn the lessons to endure the discipline, to experience the correction that he designed for us to have as obedient children. And it was here then at Shechem that Abram returned. And here again we see how, as Abram's shepherds and Lot's shepherds tended their flocks, and as the flocks increased and as the grounds became too limited for the increase of their sheep, there came this little conflict. There came a quarreling between the herdsmen. And you recall how, in humility and in deference to his nephew, Abram offers, in the most magnanimous and the most generous gesture, offers to have Lot select whichever portion of that verdant land he chose for his own pastures, and Abram would accept whatever Lot did not. There, you see, was a watershed experience. There was a decision to be made. There was a choice that was put forth. And there Lot, looking up and spying the verdant, lush overgrowth, my, was it just like unto the garden of the Lord, just like what there was in Egypt. Oh, yes, that's for me. But Lot did not think, or he did not evaluate, the fact that with that came the cities of Sodom and the cities of Gomorrah. And he did make that choice. It was a watershed choice, and he made that, and that was the one choice that determined his life thereafter. And I am sure some 20 or more years thereafter, when Lot looked back and realized that his wife was now turned to a pillar of salt, and he heard the thundering and he heard the lightning and the volcanic eruptions of Sodom and Gomorrah going into utter destruction, he must have thought of the cattle, the herds. He thought of the staff of shepherds that he had. He thought of the wealth that was so exceeding, of those lush, rich grounds. Where are they now? What did it all mean in the long, final analysis? He ran, he fled for his life, and lived in a cave, and endured the, shall I say, the ignominy of having an incestual relationship with his daughters, and bringing forth two nations that were to be a continuous irritation, an enemy of Israel. Oh yes, Shechem was a place of decision. It was a place where a decision was made, and when that decision was made, one had to live with it. And it was a decision that had its ultimate and its very unfortunate consequences. The next account that we see of Shechem occurs some two generations later. In the life of Jacob, a very inconsistent and at times a baffling character, but one that found favor and grace with God. Oh, we cannot go into some of the details of his life. Remember, though, that when he had made a subterfuge with Esau, deceived his father Isaac, and then was able to, by those means, secure the birthright. Oh yes, the birthright that Esau had renounced, but yet he was still not the firstborn. But then when Jacob realized that Esau was going to seek vengeance, Jacob fled, and he fled, and the account for that is given to us in Genesis 28:19, he fled to Bethel. And there at Bethel, he saw the great vision of this ladder. This ladder of the angels ascending and descending, this bridge between heaven and earth, this glorious panoramic insight to the millennial process and the millennial arrangement that will ultimately be brought to pass. And he knew then that there was the Lord assuring him, directing him, and letting him know that his fortunes are in God's concern and in God's hands. And then Jacob awoke out of his sleep and said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not." And he was afraid and said, "How dreadful is this place! There is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." And he called the name of that place Bethel. Then, several years later, in the 31st chapter of Genesis, when we find now Jacob again, kind of a refuge, or a refugee, or one who was a little bit of a fugitive. He was not fleeing Saul this time, but he was sneaking away, as it were, hastening away from his father-in-law Laban, whom he had served, to be sure, under very treacherous conditions, for Laban had done to Jacob what Jacob had done to Esau. Jacob switched with Esau, and now Laban switched Leah for Rachel. But having endured that, and having then known how it felt to be deceived, and how the Lord in his experiences with us sometimes gives us the bit of our own bitter medicine, if in our thoughtlessness, or if in our careless decisions, we make those turns in life's road that are not consistent with his will, he will then oft-times allow us to endure some of the very things that we were responsible for. Oh, I often think of Saul of Tarsus, how when he held the coats at the stoning of Stephen, how Saul of Tarsus must have felt when he had been stoned, when he was left, I believe it was at Ephesus, when he was left for dead, when he knew the feeling of stone against bone and felt the crush of life almost being squeezed out of him, how he must have felt, "Well, that's what I was encouraging when I held the coats of those that stoned Stephen." And so Jacob, he was now beginning to feel what it meant, you know, now to be encountering with his father-in-law, Laban. But he comes to terms with Laban at Mizpah. And then, you remember, he's got to face the music with his brother Esau. He's not now got to go back to settle the accounts and to make it right. And you remember at Peniel how God sends his angels, and they wrestle together until dawn. Remember how the account expresses it. That's Genesis 32, 28 to 30. It reads as follows. "And he said, Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, for as a prince thou hast power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. And Jacob asked him and said, Tell me, I pray thee, thy name. He said, Wherefore is that that thou askest after my name? And he blessed him there. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face. My life is preserved." He goes on to encounter Esau. The encounter goes well. The Lord's blessing is with it. In the 33rd chapter, in the 18th verse, we then get another change of fortunes. Because after the encounter with Esau, then Jacob goes and he settles at Shechem. And there he buys a piece of a parcel of a field. Genesis 33:19. "He brought a parcel of a field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money." We can't go into the gory details, but following that little period of settlement, there is a tragic event. Dinah, who is Jacob's daughter, is raped by Shechem's Hamor, by Shechem, and Hamor is so enamored of Dinah that he seeks to marry her. And he is so much in love and seems to be so passionate and so uncontrollable that he wants at all costs to take Dinah as his wife. The proposition is made where the families get together then and they begin to negotiate as to terms. as to whether or not we should enter into this contract. Oh, and the 34th chapter is so reflective of humanity at its very basic, crude levels. How the carnal mind is reasoning out such important matters that affect the destiny of people. And while Jacob was entering into negotiations, that yes, if we are to have an intermarriage of our families, then there has to be a circumcision of your males, because circumcision is the right of the Israelites, and we are Jewish, we are Israelites. Therefore, when the sons of Shechem debated the matter, they reasoned that they would go ahead, not only for the necessity or for the concern of Shechem, but rather for a concern for their own selfish interests. Hear what the writer says in the 21st verse. These men are peaceable with us, therefore let them dwell in the land and trade therein. For the land, behold, it is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us for wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only herein will the men consent unto us for to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male amongst us be circumcised as they are circumcised. And now comes the plot. Shall not their cattle and their substance and every beast of theirs be ours? Only let us consent unto them, and they will dwell with us. And unto Hamor and unto Shechem his son hearkened all that went out of the gate and the city, and every male was circumcised, all that went out of the gate of his city. Now then comes the deceit. And it came to pass on the third day, when they were sore, and I dare say, dear friends, there's nothing more helpless or more pitiable than to see a group of men who have been circumcised. We had another, or would have another, illustration of that. Remember when Joshua was about to lead Israel into the promised land, and they were crossing and had crossed the Jordan from the east to the west, and as they got to the other side, they were enjoined to have the rite of circumcision. And as the fortress of Jericho was abounding, and as the inhabitants of the lands were mobilizing, Joshua went throughout the camp and gave that order, which was, by human standards, the most thoughtless and indeed the most careless of any procedure to take. To have his men of arms completely incapacitated for as much as a week by such a surgical procedure would make them, in the vernacular, sitting ducks for any of the hostile bands that inhabited the land of Canaan. But because they had to be circumcised in order to come into the Holy Land, Joshua issued those orders. And there was nothing more helpless than such a group. Well, here, it was true that when that occurred, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. Revenge. Retribution. It was mass carnage. This is one of the black marks, shall we say, in the history of Jacob and his family. But yet it apparently had a God's tacit approval, because after the experience, God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and there make thee an altar unto God that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother." Then suddenly Jacob says unto his household, and all that were with him, "Put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments. Let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God who answereth me in the day of my distress, and was with me in the way which I went." And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the oak that was by Shechem. Here, I submit, dear friends, was a watershed experience. Here was now when Jacob, who had been inconsistent in his way of living and in his worship and in his activities, here now Jacob had determined, we are going to expunge and completely take away from us any strange gods or statuary or icons or of any cherubims that might remind us of heathen. It is, dear friends, an experience that changed Jacob's life. From here on in, we don't see any more of the vacillation or any inconsistencies in the life of Jacob. I would submit, dear friends, that this would well represent how each and every one of us does come to a point in which our decision is made to put away strange gods and be clean and change our garments and to rise up and go unto the altar of the Lord. And there, when we do so, we are taking that point, that step, that decision which results in justification. That decision which now makes us right, which makes us then worshiping the true God and putting on His righteousness. But 500 years later is the next scene in which Shechem appears in Holy Writ. And it is at the twilight of Joshua's career as the intrepid leader and director of Israel's affairs. As he was about now to die, and as he had brought Israel into the promised land, and there he supervised the subduing of that land, he now, as he was old in years and aware of his soon demise, he brought Israel back to Shechem. And in the 24th chapter of the book of Joshua, read the account. And Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for the elders of Israel and for their heads and for their judges and for their officers, and they presented themselves before God. Some 25 years earlier, Moses brought the camp of Israel to that same spot, where by Mount Gerizim and by Mount Ebal, he read to them in the 27th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, we see the account. He read to them of the blessings that would come and from their being faithful to the covenants that God had established, and the curses that would come if they failed to maintain their faithfulness to Jehovah. And here Joshua wanted to reaffirm that relationship. And we can't take the time to read it, but the entire 24th chapter shows how Joshua did confirm on three ways with three witnesses that this is the covenant, that this is whom they will serve, and warning them of the consequences of idolatry. Remember those famous words when he says, "And if it seems evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom ye will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." That was a decision. That was a decision of dedication and reaffirmation to the covenant. And as they all proclaimed on three separate statements, "Yes, we will do so," and as it was required by the law and before two or three witnesses, Joshua then laid upon them the consequences of their decision. Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and set them a statute with an ordinance in Shechem. And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God and took a great stone and set it up there under the oak that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. And Joshua said unto all the people, "Behold, this stone shall be a witness unto us, for it hath heard all the words of the Lord which he spoke unto us. It shall be therefore a witness unto you, lest ye deny your God." Oh, this stone's like a witness. Oh, just like the baptismal ritual is a witness. Just like our annual celebration of the Lord's memorial is a witness. It is an evidence of our reaffirmation and of the inner work, heart process that we have adopted, we have decided upon, and using the outward form or symbol as merely an evidence of what has already taken place within. Shechem, a point of decision, a watershed place, a place of consecration, a place whereby a dedication was made into this covenant which God had made with them. But then we find that Shechem is again very prominent in the affairs of Israel. In the 20th chapter of Joshua, in the 7th to 9th verses, the city of refuge is such a beautiful subject. We cannot enter into the content of it other than to say that it was merely given as a means of equity for one who may have committed a crime resulting in the death of another, but not from the standpoint of malicious intent and deliberate murder, but because of accidental circumstances. There was no provision in the law, eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a man's life for the man's life. Thou shalt not kill. Therefore, the law was absolute. But as the law was working through the process of daily application, it was realized that there were circumstances whereby it was unpremeditated, and that accidents did happen. And if one would be slain because of the negligence or the carelessness of another, would it require the same penalty as intentional and deliberate murder? Well, the cities of refuge were established. And in today's jurisprudence, in the American legal system as well as the British system, the concept of manslaughter has been involved or has been incorporated as one of the basic tenets of law. That concept was established here by Joshua in setting up these cities of refuge. And as you might have expected, in the 20th chapter in the 7th verse, and they appointed Kadesh in Galilee and Mount Naphtali and Shechem in Mount Ephraim and Kirjath Arba, which is Hebron, in the Mount of Judah. And so Shechem again was a place of refuge. It was a place of decision. It was a watershed experience in the history and life of Israel. And remember that one who was guilty and who did then flee to the cities of refuge, and there his case was heard by the priests. And if his case had validity, he was allowed to stay within that city and there to remain until the death of the priest, or the high priest. And then, thereafter, he can go home, he'd be free, without any danger of the kinfolk of the victim demanding life for life and an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And if the avenger of blood ever selected or caught one outside of the city of refuge, he would then be worthy of death. And so that city of refuge pictures that process in which we, as hidden in Christ, we were dead in sin, we were slain in Adam, but now as we come to the city of refuge into Christ, we remain there until the death of our high priest, after which there is to be this glorious freedom and there is to be this liberty given to all those who are captured. And so this pictures, in my judgment, sanctification. It's the period in which we are abiding in this hallowed place, if you please, in the shadow, under the shadow of the Most High. We're abiding there until the death of our high priest, until the church is completed, at which point then shall be the great work of blessing and restoring mankind. Judges 9:1-6 is the next event in the history of Shechem. I see our time is almost up, and so I must just touch this. It has to do with a very gory and a very interesting part or aspect of the period of the Judges, in which Gideon had served his mighty work as a judge, and having 70 children, there was to be expected after Gideon's departure from the scene, there was to be a power struggle amongst his sons. And Abimelech, in this most dastardly and cruel and cold-blooded murder, endeavored to slay the remaining brothers that he had, 69 in all. And he killed 68, but one escaped. And remember how Jotham escaped. And we cannot go into the parable of the trees in Judges 9, but Abimelech went into league with the men of Shechem. And there they conspired then to set Abimelech up as the king, or the ruler of Shechem. Abimelech served in that capacity for 3 years. But then the retribution of the Lord was being felt. And there was friction between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. And after some intrigue, there was a great conflict and warfare. Abimelech kills all the men of Shechem, burns the city, and salts the soil with salt. making it desolate and completely wiping it out, uninhabitable for a period of time. I submit, dear friends, Shechem, the city of refuge. A city of decision. Shechem, picturing here the second death. It was to be salted. It was burned. It had complete destruction. Well, there's one more reference in the Old Testament in which Jeroboam used Shechem as his administrative headquarters after the division of the 10 tribes of Israel from the two tribes. But I just want to touch upon after desolation that there was another grand and glorious watershed experience at Shechem. And that's found in the fourth chapter of John. Remember that most touching discourse where Jesus gave that most wonderful dialogue with the Samaritan woman. And you remember at high noon, as the disciples were going into the town in order to find some provisions, the account says that and then he cometh into the city of Samaria, which is called Sychar or Shechem, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being weary with his journey, sat thus on the well. It was about the sixth hour. Then there followed one of the most remarkable discourses and discussions. We were talking with someone earlier just this evening about how just one or two, witnessing to one or two, is so important in God's arrangements. And if we were to just take an inventory of the conversations that were so beautiful and so important, wherein, for example, on the road to Emmaus, the master talking with just those two disciples. What a wonderful discourse he gave, and how their hearts burned within them. Or when Philip, going down that down that trail in Gaza, speaking to that Ethiopian eunuch. Oh, when he opened up Isaiah 53, it must have been a thrilling talk. Only one, though, had the privilege of hearing it. And here at Shechem, only one heard that marvelous revelation, which the Master has not yet revealed to Peter, John, and James, and all the other disciples. That revelation that, yes, I am the Messiah. I am He. I am He who can give the living water, and he who drinks of this shall never thirst. Just think, what a watershed experience. What an impact, what it meant to this Samaritan woman, and this Samaritan prostitute at that. What it meant to her life. Watershed. Decision. My, she forgot her water pot, and she ran home and said to all the inhabitants of that town, come see him who knows all about me. And as they came, and as they came with the master, they were so impressed, they invited him to their homes, and for 2 days he stayed in Samaria. And he preached unto them, and they said, yes, verily, this is he whom we expect the Messiah. Not because of what she said, but because of what we heard from his lips. Watershed. Decision. But you know, the Holy Writ then is closed as it refers to this town. But you know, the record is not yet finished. Today, this is a very critical area. And this very day, this afternoon, on the news came a report that this being the 20th anniversary of the Jewish War of 1967, that in this town of Nablus has been riots. There was a killing. And it seems to be a hotbed of objection. It seems to be an Arab stronghold against the Israeli occupation. This Nablus is the town of Shechem. It is here where some more watershed experiences will be occurring. It is here where decisions will be made that will affect the welfare of Israel. All we know will affect it to the blessings of all in God's arrangement. But here is a city, a town. And if we strip it right through the strata of its history, we find such important elements whereby we ourselves can measure our watershed experiences. Here is pictured justification, consecration, sanctification, second death. And so you and I will have these kinds of experiences, you in your way and me in my way. But as they come, dear brethren, Let us accept the fact that as the blessings or as the experiences, as the afflictions and the tribulations come, whether they go into the basin of the Mediterranean, wasted and lost, or whether it goes into the armament of the new creature, into the upbuilding of that new life which is in us, into the verdant valley of the Jordan, will depend on how we allow them to affect us and how we turn their channels and their currents into the Lord's will. And may the Lord add his blessing.
We'd like to thank Brother Luke for his discourse on Shechem, our watershed. And we appreciate the experiences at Shechem and the lessons and the pictures that have been shown. Now, we're going to close our evening. We have a couple announcements to be made. And one is, for those that are staying at the dormitory, you have keys. Well, the college has a charge. If you lose those keys, it'll cost $5. So we want to remember, hold on to the keys. Don't lose them. And also, after we close, there's going to be refreshments served out in the lounge right over here. We have ice cream and pretzels and so forth. So all those that can join us, please do, and there'll be lots of fellowship there. And also, it was mentioned that the washcloths, for those that are staying in the dorm, some don't have their washcloths. No one has them. I understand the policy is that they don't give out washcloths. So I guess you'll have to try to do without them. Now, we're going to ask Brother David Harp to read the songs in the night before we close. For tonight is June the 5th, and we'll ask him to do that now, and then we'll close with a hymn and with a prayer.
My people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation, and in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. Isaiah 32:18. The closer we live to the Lord, and the greater our faith, the more we shall realize the divine direction, and the more we shall make use of the means he has provided for our strengthening and upholding. We may call upon him in time of trouble. We may go to him in prayer, and he never fails those who put their trust in him and earnestly seek to walk in his appointed way. This being true, we may go forth upon our journey in perfect trust and confidence. Having consecrated our all to the Lord, we are to seek for his guidance, for his presence is with us in all the affairs of our life. My people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation and in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. Isaiah 32:18.
Thank you, Brother David. Now we'll close with the selection of hymn number 145, and we'll rise on the last verse. And we'll ask Brother Luke to close with prayer and ask also a blessing upon our refreshments and our fellowship to follow. 145.